The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio. Keep your mission on your mind, and your mind on your mission. This is Mission Minded with Michael Coleman.
Welcome back to another Mission Minded. Keep your mind, your mission on your mind. You can find this show, of course, on TKR, the TKR app. Over 100,000 folks who download this app. We play the show at least 5 days a week. A lot of people are like, why do you play it five times a week? Because we know you're busy, and we play it in different parts of the day. And obviously, we're looking for content here at TKR. We have 14 special shows, unique shows, fantastic shows. And this is one of my favorite because I'm actually hanging out with a good friend of mine and a mentor, a man that I just really look up to, and he does fantastic work. He's the CEO of the Heart of Alabama Food Bank. He joins us every single week, plus a show called Bite by Bite, which will be airing right after the show, wherever you get your favorite podcast. Michael, what's going on, brother? How are you?
I'm glad to be here, my friend. I was away last week. I had to go to a conference. Mm-hmm. We're doing some neat things, and I had to go spend about 4 days in Oklahoma City, which was not bad. It's always interesting. I was stationed close to there back in about 30 years ago, so it was good to be back in that part of the world, but glad to be home and glad to be back with you this week.
Was this with a bunch of other food
proportioners? Yeah. One of the things that we do is we get food donations sometimes from meat manufacturers. And so we have a Tyson plant in our area that donates fresh chicken. The problem is that they do it in huge vats, you know, like 1,500 pound pallets, and it's all the parts mixed together. Well, the problem is we need to repack that into like 5 pound bags so we can distribute out to families. But to touch meat and to process meat and repackage meat, you actually have to be under the guidance and the oversight of the USDA to be able to do that. So there's only 9 food banks currently who have a protein repack room where they're authorized to do that. So the conference was everybody who has it. Now, we don't have that, but we're adding that.
Okay.
And so we're either going to be 10th or 11th to add the protein repack room. And so it was a bunch of food bankers out there with meat producers, but also people who sell the equipment, and just trying to say, what's the best way to, do you use volunteers? Do you use employees? Do you do multiple shifts? You know, do you stay with, do you break apart frozen or do you take fresh? I mean, there's a million questions that you might not think about. That all have to be determined before you step into this.
Is this something that you wanted to take on? And what does it mean for Heart of Alabama Food Bank down in Montgomery to be able to do this?
It's really huge because I'll give you an example. It's incumbent upon every food bank when we sign up with a contract under Feeding America. So we have 35 counties. Part of what our job is to source food in our area. So that could be farmers and produce. It could be anything. And so when you have meat suppliers, it could be a slaughterhouse for chickens, farm, whatever. Well, this particular Tyson plant in Eufaula, Alabama, processes 1.2 million chickens a week.
Well,
and they make spicy wings for Burger King and Wendy's. They do Buffalo Wild Wing chicken wings and Pizza Hut and on and on and on. So it's an amazing operation. And sometimes they get miscut pieces that they can't use. They're the same chicken. They're just, the machine cuts them funny. They don't want to package them that way. So they just put them up for donation. Now they get the tax write-off, but in the past they didn't have anybody who could take it. They were having to just throw this chicken away. And so now we're able to source it. We take it to a USDA facility, have them repackage it. Then we bring it back here and put it into the network. And either we distribute it to our folks or we help other food banks distribute it in their area. So all this food that gets donated comes into our network. And we're talking about a truckload a week. So we're talking right now on average about 20,000 pounds of chicken a week.
Wow.
That's getting donated into our system. And it's a win-win for everybody. We're, you know, that's a healthy protein that we're getting in to getting to people in need. Tyson doesn't have to experience waste, and they get a tax write-off for what they donate. So it's just all of us working together to solve the problem of hunger.
You know, I worked at Kentucky Fried Chicken when I was like 15 through about 18. I worked about 3 years there. And what a lot of people don't realize is and we get our chicken from a corporation called Bob's Chicken. Mm-hmm. And they'd bring a chuck, you know, once or twice a week, and it would come in bags. It was already cut up in the actual piece itself. There was a keel, which is the centerpiece between the two breast sides. And then, of course, the two thighs and the two wings. And it was there were two head per chicken per bag.
Yeah.
Most times it was frozen. And there was one thing, because we used these giant fryers, it would cook 12 head of chicken at a time. Obviously, you're not cooking chicken down there at the heart of Alabama Food Bank, although that'd be, you know, you could do Kentucky Fried Chicken right out of your store. But in order to get it to cook right, you had to have the thighs, they had to sit flat. And so when they're processed, they're curved. And so there's a tail on one end that needs to be broken off. And then you need to take the bone part, and run it across your fingers and break it so it sits flat, or else it's not cooking fully. And so so that was one of our jobs, not only to you know, batter it up and to put flour and everything, but we had to actually break the chicken up as soon as it would come in. And sometimes we'd be breaking it, it would be going straight onto the fryer because the truck was late or whatever. But I'm 15, 16, I'm working at Kentucky Fried Chicken. You can only imagine how bad my face looked, my complexion with the pimples and everything. But then I'm breaking this chicken, and you didn't use gloves.
Yeah.
I just remember my hands being so bloody, and just, I mean, it was disgusting how ripped up my hands were. So a lot of people don't realize, you know, what goes in. And that was like at a KFC. I don't know if they still do it that way.
I don't know either, but I will tell you that it's important for people to understand how much we emphasize safety. Mm-hmm. So when we're bringing food into the network, I mean, safety is of utmost importance. And when you process, every bag has to have a new label on it. It has to be sealed properly. It has to have any sort of potential allergens listed on the bag, so that families getting it. And if it was ever recalled, we could trace that chicken. So it has to be packed in a virtually germ-free, sanitary place. That's what the USDA is there for, to make sure that we're adhering to all those standards. And it should be reassuring that there's no shortcuts being taken, that we do it just like the major manufacturers are required to do. We're bringing this in the system. We're rescuing this food, saving it out of the landfill. But we're ensuring that we're doing it well and to a high standard, and also very safe way.
As messed up as this country is in some things, food safety is one of the things that we take very, very seriously around here. And I've seen the salmon. Yeah. You hear about salmon, I'm like, oh, we're first world country. How in the world does it happen? I got news for you. You travel somewhere else, Jamaica, wherever else, you see how their distribution works, and you feel pretty good about it. He is Michael Coleman, CEO of the Heart of Alabama Food Bank. This is called Mission Minded. Shall we start off doing talk about non-for-profits and things like that? And then we just kind of talked about business. So whenever I see an article, I think is really interesting. And you've pretty much been there, done that. You've worked in every facet, everything from non-for-profits for business, as an owner, as a boss, as an employee. You've pretty much worked every part of it. So I see an article. I've been a tech recruiter for 19 years. For giants like Google, there are four questions you should ask at the end of an interview. And of course, the right thing that's clickbait to me, because I think we're always trying to figure out, you know, outside of having a good attitude, making a good first impression, smelling good, you know, doing all the right things when you go into an interview process, you want to make that first impression, and you only get one of those. And so I was reading some of the questions, and none of them really kind of blew me off my feet. And again, we're talking about a tech company. So I just want to go through it. Can you tell me about my future team was the first question. Is the opportunity remote or hybrid? And this article just came out a couple months ago, so it does have something to do with the COVID thing. What is the growth story of this particular role? And then what are the biggest challenges the team, department, or company faces now? That last question was the one question where I think it's probably the most important question, because you could ask that of any business, whether you're going to work at Kohl's or work at Kentucky Fried Chicken or work at the Heart of Alabama Food Bank. But I did want to ask you, and I certainly want you to expound on those particular things and kind of give me a yay or nay. And yeah, that's a good point. Or as a guy who is interviewed thousands and thousands of people, not only there where you work now, but certainly in your past. What are some questions, or what are some things you're looking for from a prospective employee, regardless of what kind of job you're looking for. And I want you to bare bones it. Go all the way down to, is it important, obviously, that they look nice? Or is it dependent on whether they cover up the tattoo? How important is it that they have really good management of their language? Just talk about some of those things. And then I want you to throw a couple of zingers out. What are some things do you ask? Do you ask some employees some questions that perhaps they don't see coming? Like one of the questions, where do you see yourself in 3 years? I mean, it's a standard question. I'm talking some good Michael Coleman questions.
Well, I don't know how many of those I have, but I will tell you, it's very interesting because I have a very different approach depending on what the circumstances, because I've got in some ways some conflicting values. So I'll explain it this way. So I'm a big second chance guy. So knowing I've spent so much time dealing with people in poverty and understanding that, trying to understand that world, knowing that if I get somebody who's come from the prison system and I'm going to hire them as a warehouse worker, and they're going to come in, and let's say they're not dressed as you might desire for a job interview. But I also understand lots of times, so I might not judge them on that particular thing because I understand, you know, maybe they've not had anybody to prep them. This is not somebody, you know. And in terms of language, one of the things that has really jumped out to me about people in poverty is middle class has two registers. Typically, you have a formal register and you have a casual register. The formal register, like when I'm switching into, I'm interviewing for a job, I want to make sure that I have, you know, the verb subject agreement and all that other kind of stuff. I want to sound like I've sat down in a classroom, that I can write and all that, because that's, and then I can speak intelligently. People in poverty lots of times just come to you and they just have the casual register. So they may use even profanity sometimes in talking and expressing themselves. But depending on what I'm interviewing for, it may matter or it may not matter. If I'm looking for a warehouse worker or a truck driver, I'm not at all demeaning those jobs. I'm just saying it's a different skill set than if you're hiring for a director of development that's going to be out with the community and civic groups and all that representing your brand.
Sure.
Yeah. So when I go into that, I'm looking at what am I hiring? What are my expectations? And then the truth of the matter is I'm probably an HR's worst nightmare. And actually, I've been called that by more than one person. Wow. And the reason is because the latest and greatest out there is, hey, there's certain things you can't mention. You can't ask people. And so you can't ask things like, do you have a family? Because that could be prejudicial.
These are real questions you're throwing out, or are you just using these as examples?
No. Well, I mean, these are questions that I've been told specifically you can't ask.
Okay.
You can't ask somebody, are they married? You can't ask somebody, do they have a family? Do they have kids? Because you might think, oh, if they have kids, then they're going to be pulled away. They're more apt to be pulled away from work. So you would use that as a discrimination.
Are you allowed to expound on them if they bring it up first?
Yes.
Okay. And
so that's the question. If they raise the issue, The tendency with a lot of people is to give a very guarded interview. And I totally get it because we live in a very litigious world and people are just waiting to blame you for, oh, well, you didn't have any reason asking this. I do know of a guy who was interviewing a guy, and he himself was a believing Christian, and asked the person, did he go to church? And the person said yes, and asked which denomination he was part of. And then started arguing about Bible things from a different denomination. And so his HR told him, look, you might as well go ahead and hire that person because you have set yourself up for a lawsuit, because if you turn him down, he's going to say it's religious discrimination. So those kind of things are foolish, you know, to engage somebody in a negative way. But what I try to do is to create an informality, if possible. I want to put them at ease. I'm not trying to put them under such pressure, because I want to authentically know what they think and what they feel. I'm not looking for pat answers. I want them to express how they genuinely are. And that causes me sometimes to then ask probing questions. And so I have to be very careful. This is why they call me HR's worst nightmare, is because I'm very apt to cross some sort of line that I'm not thinking in the moment I'm crossing, because I just genuinely am interested in the person. I'm genuinely interested in how their personality is going to fit. Do they like working for somebody who watches over them closely? You know, because I'm not a micromanager, but I have high expectations of the workforce, you know, and so lots of times my interviews devolve into just a very casual conversation. And that probably makes, if you're HR and you're listening to this, you're probably saying, oh, that's wrought with all sorts of problems. But the reality is, I'm trying to get the right person for our culture, for to meet the needs of the position, but also somebody who fits our cultural expectations. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I just have to take those risks in asking those kind of questions, because the harm is if I don't find that out, then I shut down the process. I bring this person in, I give them 30, 60, 90 days, and I find out this is a total bust. I'm right back to where. So all the lost time, all the lost productivity, all the problems, the upheaval of having to dismiss somebody, bring somebody new in, going through that whole process. To me, asking them some probing questions, or at least engaging them in that way, seems less risky to me.
Has there ever been someone that you've interviewed, depending on the position you're looking for, and obviously they weren't overly qualified for the position you're looking for, that you remember that you thought, wow, this has been an amazing interview. It's too bad I can't hire this person because there's no way that this job's well beneath them. Question number one, or has anyone ever posed a question to you that you just were really surprised by?
You know, sometimes people,
are you married, Mike?
Yeah. Yeah, I've never been hit on an interview, but that probably has more to do with me than than not finding me attractive. We've had some interesting conversations. I've had people dress sometimes very provocatively in ways that let's just say with women. Who dress in very, like they're going to the club and not coming into a professional environment.
At Heart of Alabama or other places?
At other places, primarily, yeah. Of what they thought were stylish and fashionable. They were dressing for the position, but it was just a total swing and a miss and like not... And wearing things that were very loud. I remember this lady came in and she had extended fingernails that were about, 3 to 4 inches past the tips of her finger, but they were painted literally banana yellow.
Wow.
And so she looked like she had 10 bananas hanging off her fingertips. And it was so distracting that I was just having trouble focusing on what she was saying, because she was talking with her hands and it looks like she was waving all these little bananas at me. And people don't think, about what kind of image. I'm like, well, if this person's going to be doing development and this person are going to be interacting with the public, you know, it may even be hard to take them serious. Now, That may have been a great look at the club or going out in the evenings, but in a business environment, again, it is a different challenge. I did look at these same questions you did. I did find some very not exactly as they have them worded, but because right now I'm undergoing a director level interview, and I just had one of these very casual conversations. As a matter of fact, when I already knew the person, so when I jumped on the horn with them, I was like, look, I just want to have an informal conversation. I just want to know where you are, where I am, and let you know where I am. I'll usually lead with, and oh, by the way, there's nothing that's off limits. You can ask me any question you want to. And lots of times what I'm listening for is, oh, I feel the same way. Ask me anything. And I would say more than half the time they come back with that. And I go, oh, well, thank you, because there are some things that I looked at your resume and I wonder about, or I have heard, we both have a common friend and they have mentioned these things. And, you know, I would like some further clarification on that. So once they open up that door and invite you into any question, then I feel like I'm in pretty good shape. But the thing that I found interesting about what this Google representative mentioned was, can you tell me about your future team? That used to be a question years ago that would never be asked about, tell me who I'm going to be working with. But everything is so social, to include the workforce, that is a question on people's minds. And I even understand it, because it may sound like a bold question, but the reality is, I don't want people, I'm interviewing people and I'm trying to evaluate through this interview process, are you going to be somebody who comes in and enhances our culture? Are you going to disrupt our culture? So I'm concerned about them coming in and how they're going to intermingle with everybody else. So it only makes sense that they would be concerned about that. How am I going to fit in? And is fitting in important to you as a boss? So there's a lot of things about that question. We mentioned is the opportunity to be remote or hybrid. And that sounds so 2 years ago, back during COVID, because that became such an issue. But let me tell you a question that has come up. I get this kind of question quite a bit. What is your leave? What's your vacation policy? And we go, okay, it's 12 days paid vacation, 12 days sick leave. Okay. And I said, but I also have lots of flexibility in how I count that. So for instance, if somebody says, my child is sick, I'm not sick, but my child is sick, then I could say, okay, well, if you have to stay home with your child, you're going to get charged today. But if you have a job to where you can work from home, which obviously isn't a warehouse worker, but if you work in development and you're going over stats and submitting whatever you're doing on email or computer, I'm like, well, you can stay home with your child. But if you choose to work from home, if you can do these things from home, then I won't charge you.
Yeah.
So it's not a hybrid position. It's not a remote position. But I try to provide maximum flexibility for people to say, I get it. You're not going to literally be in the office. Can you still do your tasks from where you are? And if you are, we can kill two birds with one stone. I can let you meet your family needs while also meeting the company needs. And if we could do that, that's best case scenario. Sometimes that can't be done. I'm like, no, you would have to take vacation or you would have to take sick. But I try to accommodate that in. And it's a form of hybrid, but not a true hybrid. Like, they don't get to select when to come in and when to go out. We're not going to have set days, but I try to provide them maximum flexibility so they don't use sick days on days that they're not sick. They don't use vacation days on days they're not vacationing. I try to reserve that for that time.
What are some things that, if I wanted to come work for you, what are some things I can look up outside going to your website? And maybe go check out your social media platform, you know, find out who your favorite teams are. So at least we have something in common give me a couple things. If I don't know you from Adam's House Count, what are some things that I can look up about Michael Coleman or about the Heart of Alabama Food Bank that would get my foot in the door a little bit better than someone that's come in cold call?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to tell you, everybody that comes in, this is very important because we post, if we're looking for a job on Indeed, and then we put it all on our social media, so we'll put it on LinkedIn, we'll put it on we'll share it to our Facebook pages individually across the company. So we have a company platform, but then individuals. And when somebody comes in and sits at my desk, and I've had their interview scheduled for 3 or 4 days, and I come in, the very first question that I always ask them is, have you read your job description? And if they say, no, I haven't read my job description, I'm like, you are interviewing for a job of which you don't even know what I'm asking you to be.
Yeah.
So you have not even read it and evaluated as to whether you're a good fit. Now you're asking me to evaluate whether you're a good fit.
Why would you even answer that question that way, though? Do you actually have people that do that?
Yes, I have people. I would say half the time.
That's amazing.
People go, Well, I surface reading because they're scared I'm going to ask them a specific question.
Yeah.
About it. And so they're like, well, I glanced at it. I didn't get into the weeds, or I was just focused on the benefit portion or whatever. And yeah, they do it all the time. And that lets me know, it just says something. It's almost like the old, like my dad taught me this, is so ingrained in me. You shake a man's hand, and if he does not look you in the eye and give you a firm handshake, there's do not go deeper into a relationship with a man who can't look you in the eye and give you a firm handshake. Mm-hmm. It's kind of that same red flag that goes up. Like, you came in wanting me to give you a job, paying you good money. I've listed out these 30 responsibilities or expectations on my part, and you didn't even take the time to read it before you came in.
Yeah.
That speaks. That's a character issue to me. And it would be, I don't remember hiring any of those no's. No, I hadn't had a chance to look at it, or no, I haven't looked at it. I love once. Well, actually, the last two questions. What is the growth of a particular role? And the reason I like that is when I'm hiring at a lower level, I tell employees, I want to pay you at a level that's so competitive, and I want to give you the culture that's the best culture that when nobody else can come along and steal you for $1,000. Okay, because some people who are looking to get out of a place, if they're just like, hey, pay me what I'm making now, I'd just rather come to work for you. So I want to pay them competitively, have them enjoy coming to work, feel a sense of purpose and all that. And part of, because it is so costly to businesses for somebody to, you train them, you invest in them, and less than a year, they up and they're gone. I want to tell people who are looking for jobs, be so mindful of this. I just got a resume sent to me, and this person has changed jobs every year. Now, this person may be moving up, but it looks like it's pretty parallel positions.
Okay.
Instant red flag to me, because what that tells me is that person's going to come in, and as soon as they have a bad day, or as soon as they don't like what's going on, or as soon as they don't get their way, their resumes are going to be out there and they're looking, and I'm going to invest in this person, and whether the right fit or wrong fit, and boom, they're going to be gone. And now I'm back, and that creates turmoil and destabilizes at least a department. So when somebody's saying, hey, is there a growth potential there? In some parts, I start evaluating and go, okay, they're looking longer term.
Mm-hmm.
They're not just looking at this position and getting through today. They're saying, okay, if I come in, what levels are above here, and will I be able to have an opportunity to get those? And I take that as a positive, because somebody who's looking in their mind, they're looking, how do I get better? And I want to, if there's an opportunity to get better within your company, then I want to be here longer term. And then the thing that we both talked about is what the biggest challenges on the team. And I think that's very insightful. I don't get asked that question a lot. Lots of times I'll volunteer, like when I'm talking to this development person last night, I said, well, let me tell you about your team. I just volunteered it. I didn't wait for them to ask me. And I kind of gave them a rundown of how I assess their team. And they have some really strong people. They have a few that, you know, just need some more seasoning, if you will. They're just young. Generally, you know, very positive. But if you're a manager, you have to be concerned about what you're walking into. And for somebody to give you an honest assessment, and that gives you an opportunity to match. Oh, you mean there's a lot of infighting, or there's a lot of jealousy? Well, then I get to make a decision. Do I want to go in there and fix that? Or do I just want to say, nah? Because I had one person who said, Michael, I'd love to come work for you, and I'd love to be back in the nonprofit world, but I don't want to supervise people. People are messy. I said, hey, I get it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I've got to have the person supervise this department, but I totally get it. I'd love to have you, but I understand, because if you're not in it to win it with supervising people, if you're not willing to commit the time and lead them and set that example and communicate with them and help develop them, which is exhausting, Some people are just absolutely not cut out for it. And it's not a character flaw. It just means they're not a good fit for that particular position.
If you like what you hear and see, check us out on our other YouTube channels here for Bite by Bite. Another great show about the Heart of Alabama Food Bank is coming up here next on TKR and wherever you get your favorite podcast. Until next week, my friend, thank you.
Thank you. Enjoyed it as always.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.